Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Let's say, just for argument's sake, you get to decide how to get Vladimir Putin to behave himself. What sanctions do you pick? What penalties do you impose? Yeah, not so easy, is it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, July the 21st. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Vladimir Putin, it is probably safe to assume, spent a lot of time on the phone this weekend. He took calls from the leaders of Britain, France, and Germany about Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, and those are just the calls that we know of. At the White House this morning, President Obama added his call for Putin to do something about the crash site and the investigation.
We have to make sure that the truth is out. And that accountability exists.
Economic sanctions have been the tool of choice to date to deal with Russia and its actions in Ukraine and Crimea. Sanctions that have been limited in their effect. But if the West really wanted to get President Putin's attention, squeeze him just a little bit, not saying they will, but if they wanted to, what could they possibly do? From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
For months, the Europeans bickered over stepping up sanctions against the Kremlin. Countries like Britain want to hit the Russians hard, but the Germans and the Italians, who are heavily dependent on Russian energy, are afraid of antagonizing President Putin. Britain's Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, says the downing of Flight MH17 changes everything, uniting the Europeans.
What we need to do now is use the sense of shock, the sense of outrage, to galvanize opinion behind a more robust stance. We have tools in our toolbox.
The UK wants to follow the US example and slap Putin's inner circle of oligarchs with visa bans and asset freezes, even though that could harm London's financial sector. Nina Schick of the Open Europe think tank says the Europeans could also use their leverage as Russia's biggest trading partner.
They could also target European exports to Russia, which Russia is dependent on. We're talking about things like machinery, medicine. And now these are also things that Russia won't be able to source easily from other places.
Russia could retaliate by turning off the oil and natural gas that supplies 30% of Europe's energy needs. But that would spark an all-out economic conflict. And James Nixey of the Chatham House think tank says Europe would win it.
Any economic war would be compounded fivefold on Russia compared to that of the EU. If it were to genuinely get serious, then the effects on Russia would be such that President Putin, I think, is actually a very worried man right now.
But as they prepare for their meeting tomorrow, some European foreign ministers are also very worried. They'll have to punish Putin, but without driving up their own energy costs and tipping their fragile economies back into recession. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Transportation Safety Administration, they of the airport screenings that we all know and love so well, have some news for the traveling public. As of today, they are increasing the fees, doubling the fees, more than that actually, that airline passengers are charged for their services. It's now up to $5.60 a flight, which we thought made this a good day to itemize the average airfare. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour walks us through it.
Let's go on a little trip from New York to L.A. Here is a fare for $513. Okay, so here's the recently increased fee.
The TSA so-called September 11th fee, $560 per one-way journey.
That's John Heimlich with Airlines for America. It's an airline industry trade group. My flight has a layover in each direction, so that comes to $22. All right, and here's an excise tax.
Right, and that's 7.5% of the base airfare.
That's another $25. Okay, and oh, here's another tax.
A flight segment tax, $4 flat per segment.
Okay.
Airport passenger facility charge, $4.50 per segment.
Okay, then. So now we are at $81 out of 500, and that's a tax rate of about 16%. And that's just with domestic flights. International flights have a whole additional set of fees. But what about if I want to travel in some kind of rudimentary basic comfort whatsoever? Bob Mann is an airline consultant. What do I pay for legroom these days?
$25 up to hundreds of dollars.
Check a bag?
Up to $70 or $80.
Not check a bag. Carry on.
Up to $100.
Okay, what if I just want to eat, okay?
$5 for a snack, $12 or $15 for a nice sandwich.
Airlines don't pay taxes on those extras, and the money that is generated for the TSA doesn't all go to the TSA, says George Hobica with AirfareWatchdog.com.
A lot of the money actually ends up in the general fund to reduce the deficit, and it never sees its way, as it was intended, to improve air travel.
You know, who needs travel, really? I'm just going to stay home and read about other people traveling. In New York, I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
The Dodd-Frank financial reform bill was signed into law 4 years ago today, which means, yeah, no, it means nothing. Wall Street on this Monday, comme ci, comme ça. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're doing a series of interviews this week with people from a pretty wide range of fields about something that they all have in common, a really good idea, and the creativity, the risk tolerance, and the perseverance to make that idea stick. To start things off today, Tony Fadell. He worked at Apple on the first generations of the iPod, and then 3 years ago founded Nest Labs, most famous for that fancy thermostat that doesn't need to be programmed, but instead learns your habits and your behavior and thus your temperature preferences. Tony, thanks so much for coming on.
Hi, Kai. It's great to be here.
So listen, did you wake up one day and say, all right, well, now that I've done, you know, Apple and big design stuff there, I think I'm going to do thermostats? Is that how this happened?
Well, in a way, it sort of did. It was really through a process of building and designing a home for my family. You know, I was trying to understand what a new home would look like when you have access to it from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. What would a connected home look like, and what would a green home look like? Putting those two things together and reimagining the experience inside of a home when you have those two technologies.
To the point about being able to control this thing from your smartphone and it learning and all that, I know you are not a big proponent of the idea of the Internet of Things, that eventually our refrigerator is going to know how much milk we have. And yet, this is maybe a key element in the Internet of Things. Explain that.
Well, you know, look, at the end of the day, well, all we've done is we've taken a product, a thermostat.
Yeah.
It's not the Internet of Things. It's an internet-connected thermostat to allow you to gain access to it from anywhere to control it. But the other big piece of this is information, to allow us to create energy reports for you, to show you how you're behaving, how you're using energy, and what things you might be able to do to save more money and save more energy. So when it becomes connected, it's not just about remote control and linking it to other things. It's really about giving you the information necessary to make better choices.
You know, I get all that, but there is an element of big data to this thing, because you guys now know when I will turn my thermostat down to go on vacation. You know, you know, when I've left for work, right? I mean, you know all this stuff that maybe I don't want you to know.
That's true that, you know, when you have this connectivity, that there might be some downsides to it, of course. But think of it this way. We can't bring that kind of convenience to you unless it actually has that connectivity. Now, remember, if you look at something like your smartphone today, and most people won't give up their smartphones, it also knows when you're home and when you're away. It also knows all of these other things about you.
Total change of gears here. What is it about design for you that is so attractive? I mean, you were in on the iPhone and the iPod at Apple, and now you've done this thing, which is, you know, for thermostats, it's a pretty good-looking little device.
Thanks. Well, really, if you put the love into a product and you want to change people's behaviors or the way they think about something, you also have to change the exterior of it. You know, if you look at, and the interactions of it, if you look at products on the wall today, thermostats on the wall, they're ignored. People don't want to program them. They don't really use them. So what we decided was make sure you make it a loved product, something that is, attracts the eye. And then people engage with it and they say, hey, maybe there's something really cool there. Maybe there's something I can learn from it.
Talk to me for a second about
market disruption. I mean, you guys did that at Apple with the devices there, and you're trying to do it here. One wonders whether you're going to be as successful as Apple was.
Well, you know, today, most thermostats are sold in wholesale. What we've done is we've gone where you actually buy a smartphone in Best Buy, at Amazon, at the various places where you would learn about high technology consumer electronics. Mm-hmm. We want to be there. We think we can capture an outsized share of the market that is a robust market.
Quickly, before I let you go, what do you think of the idea that's been floated out there in some think pieces lately about this idea that disruption and innovation are overrated, that you know, they're not all they're shook up to be?
Well, look what's happening with electric cars. We're shaking up the market. Look what happened with MP3s. You know, the iPod existed because of MP3s. These kinds of disruptive technologies allow us to create all kinds of new businesses, new services. Look at Uber. These things are amazing technology disruptions that are packaged properly for consumers to be able to embrace. I think we're only going to see more and more of these kinds of changes coming, not less and less.
Tony Fadell, CEO and founder of Nest. Tony, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai. Have a great day.
When you go shopping for a big appliance, what's one of the first things you look for? Yes, price, sure, of course. Fit and compatibility, also sure, of course. But right up near the top of that list is probably that Energy Star sticker, right? It's a pretty well-known consumer brand, I guess you'd say, run by the EPA and the Department of Energy. The program is not without some issues, though. A couple of years ago, GAO, the Government Accountability Office, scammed it into certifying bogus products as Energy Star efficient. And today, the New York Times reports that Whirlpool is threatening to back out of Energy Star unless Congress gives manufacturers, like Whirlpool, immunity from consumer lawsuits. Marketplace's Dan Weissman looks at what an Energy Star label is worth today.
The Government Accountability Office report on Energy Star back in 2010 was a doozy. Sharon Baker Brandstetter is an attorney with Consumers Union. Here's her take on the bottom line.
Because really, EPA wasn't looking at every application. The manufacturers were self-certifying.
So GAO investigators submitted an application for a gasoline-powered alarm clock. It got listed. They submitted a room air cleaner and linked to a picture of an electric space heater with a feather duster attached. That got listed, too. Here's Ann Bailey, who runs the Energy Star products program for EPA.
So since then, we've dramatically improved the rigor of the certification process, and we've instituted third-party certification.
Third-party certification means that manufacturers now submit their products to an EPA-approved lab, like Underwriters Laboratories, which signs off. The third parties also pull a few products off the shelf every year to see if they measure up to the claims. That led to 62 products getting disqualified last year. Steve Nadell is executive director of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
I think EPA has done a good job of addressing the concerns that GAO had.
A good enough job that he thinks the proposed legislation that would protect companies like Whirlpool from some consumer lawsuits is reasonable. The proposed bill only applies in cases where EPA has done a review.
I think consumers do tend to trust EPA.
Sales figures collected by EPA seem to back him up. Even in the years after the GAO report, the number of Energy Star products sold continued to increase. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we're going to be talking about goods and services and consumers and producers and spending and saving.
Doesn't get any better than that, does it? And did you hear the kid crying in the background? That was my favorite part. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 0.25% today. 48 points closed at 17,051. The NASDAQ gave back 0.1%, 7 points, 44.24. The S&P 500 slipped 0.2%, 4 points, closed at 1973. Financials went both ways. Bank of America picked up 0.2%. Goldman Sachs gained about 0.1%. Morgan Stanley off 0.2% today. Chipotle reported stronger than expected earnings despite raising restaurant prices. Shares up about 8% after the bell. And from the big money file comes mobile software maker Counterpath, which climbed more than 30% after announcing a new patent deal. Bond prices rose. You know what happens when that happens, right? The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.46%. You are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. We get a look at the housing market. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for June. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its Consumer Price Index, also for June. And this is the game show host who turns 74 tomorrow. Answer, who is Alex Trebek? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is not at all uncommon when somebody puts their house on the market to stage the thing, fill it with nice furniture and art, rented furniture and art, of course, to make it look nicer. Some companies take that model one step farther. They stage the humans. They find people to actually live in the houses for sale to make them feel more like homes. From WUNC, Eric Mennel reports.
About a year ago, Cora Blinsman's mom passed away. Needless to say, it was really hard on her. She started taking stock of her own life. Cora had been a full-time stay-at-home mom for 20 years, and she was feeling burnt out. She needed space, so she got a lot of it.
I love the kitchen because it's got two cooking surfaces. You got the gas and the electric.
Cora applied to be a home manager with Show Homes, a nationwide home staging company. Basically, she pays a monthly fee to live in a really nice house for sale in one of Chapel Hill, North Carolina's nicest upscale communities. This one is currently going for $430,000. The idea behind Show Homes is that when someone lives in a home, it just feels warmer, more attractive to buyers.
They see how you live in the house. You got your bedroom slippers in the bedroom. And I mean, I kept it very neat, but you could tell that somebody lived there.
Buyers are smart. They can tell they're walking into a staged home.
Fred Pearson is the franchise manager for Show Homes in the Chapel Hill area. He says the home manager method is the company's most effective service. 70% of the homes with managers living in them get an offer. And these are not always easy homes to sell. They're often worth more than $1 million. The home Cora is in had been on the market for a year before she moved in, about 2 months ago. Now, she pays $1,100 a month for a home that would normally have mortgage payments 2 to 3 times that amount. So it's a good deal. But Pearson says there are drawbacks.
If home managers are doing this just for the savings, then it will not work. It has to be a lifestyle that they are willing to compromise.
For example, Cora only lived in her first home for 5 weeks before it sold. Some managers can move up to 5 times a year. And there are rules.
They're very basic. You make your bed every day. Towels are not hung up over the shower. They are placed in the dryer, so they're warm when you come home.
You know, pick your stuff up and make sure it looks nice. And the stuff I was always telling my kids, you know.
Also, don't keep anything too personal lying around. No religious insignia, no personal photos.
We had one house that had murals of a football team. We really can't have that because the buyers may love the house but hate that football team.
Cora says the rules haven't been so bad. On the contrary, this home at this time has been really good for her. She says living in a wealthy community has opened her eyes to an entirely different lifestyle.
I can be a part of the community and I can fit in very well, but if I had a little broken down car, I could never drive through this neighborhood. I would just be like, oh my God, you know, they're going to want to throw me out.
And this is the real trick behind Show Home's success. It's not just about giving the buyer a look into someone else's life. It's about doing the same for the home manager, giving them a chance to be someone else, if only for a little while. In Chapel Hill, I'm Eric Mennel for Marketplace.
You can order stuff online until the cows come home, but at some point, the company from which you buy whatever it is has to figure out how to get it to your house. Amazon, whence a whole lot of us buy stuff online, rolled out in some cities earlier this year, same-day shipping on groceries, Amazon Fresh, it's called. Now they're taking that idea one step further, using what they know about us to guess what people in a given area might want to buy, light bulbs, toilet paper, what have you, then putting that on a truck that patrols the streets waiting for somebody to place an order. They are, in a way, shipping the stuff even before we buy it. Marcus Woltzen writes about that, Amazon's new plan, that is, for Wired. Marcus, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
We did a quick thing on this anticipatory package shipping algorithm that Amazon has come up with a little while ago. And in all honesty, I kind of poo-pooed it because it seems ridiculous on the face. Not so, you say.
Well, you know, it depends on how you think about them using it. Yes, if you sort of think about a package suddenly arriving at your door that you didn't order.
Unbidden, yeah.
That's right. One thing. But our idea was that as Amazon tries to roll out same-day delivery, that this anticipatory shipping algorithm could be used to kind of figure out what to put in these trucks. And then, lo and behold, somebody orders something that Amazon predicted they or someone in that general vicinity would order, and it's already on that truck ready to bring to that person's door.
The idea, though, of those trucks trolling through neighborhoods is well nigh apocalyptic, right? I mean, it totally makes sense because that's the way it's got to work. But can you imagine?
Well, it's not as apocalyptic as Amazon sending out a million drones.
Drones,
from its
yeah,
warehouses.
That's a whole different Wired article, man. We're not even going there.
Yeah. Well, you know, it actually does relate to this whole concept because when Amazon came out with this idea of drones, and of course that attracted a lot of attention.
Yeah, in that 60 Minutes piece a couple of months ago, yeah.
Exactly. But it doesn't actually make a whole lot of sense for the way Amazon operates. Like, it's really actually a pretty inefficient idea to send out an individual drone for every order that somebody places. But when you think about a truck, it's not nearly as sexy as a drone. Yeah. But especially after this last holiday season where a lot of orders came late from Amazon and there was a real sort of public back and forth between Amazon, UPS, FedEx over whose fault it really was, Amazon would love to have its own truck so that they don't have to so that they can be in control. If there's one thing that Amazon likes, it's to be in control.
Other than doing it because they can, what are they trying to accomplish? Because it does seem a little bit gimmicky. I mean, yes, I know we're a society now that wants everything when we want it, but come on.
For Amazon, it continues to be about this push to overtake brick-and-mortar stores as the main way that people buy things. I mean, online retail is still a very small portion of commerce in the U.S. It's something like 6% of retail purchases. So there's a lot of runway left for Amazon. And Amazon still isn't a particularly profitable company.
Yeah, which actually is an important fact, right? I mean, Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, has foregone profits to get this logistics hub and all of this stuff up and running.
Right. It's to get big.
Right.
But in order for that to justify itself, at this point, it still has to get bigger.
Marcus Wilson, he writes for Wired. Marcus, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
If, by some chance, sprinklers or slip and slides or other more typical joys of summertime just are not doing it for your kids this year, you might consider sending them to Fed Camp. Yes, you heard me right. The Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond runs a summer program for kids, workshops, really, designed to boost their basic economic know-how. We sent Kate Davidson to check it out.
Come on up. Keep coming in. Let's get everybody in.
Angela Collier gathers a group of rising kindergartners, 4 and 5-year-olds, around her. And in her best "This is awesome" voice, she tells them,
"We're going to be talking about goods and services and consumers and producers and spending and saving."
Oh, yeah. It's Fed Boot Camp.
I wouldn't call it Fed Boot Camp.
Melanie Rose oversees the Richmond Fed's summer camp challenge. You can tell she's totally scouting for the next Janet Yellen or Ben Bernanke.
Well, if we happen to find one, I'm sure we would take it. But no.
Okay, so this is more like Fed Lite, a chance for almost 1,000 kids to stop by, play games about personal finance, and build their economic knowledge. But let's just say you were secretly grooming future Fed chairs. You'd start young, right? And step one? Establish everyone's weight in gold.
Probably all of you weigh about that much, about 1.5, maybe 2 gold bars.
That's Collier again with 4 and 5-year-olds. Now that they've got the gold standard down, step two, teach them the difference between a service and a good.
And it's something that you can touch and feel and take home. Can you think of anything that would be an example of a good?
Play-Doh.
Play-Doh is a great example of a good.
AJ Salvato, save that kid a space on the Federal Open Market Committee. Step three, practice. The kids turn over cards with pictures of cars and clocks and waiters.
A service?
A good.
A good?
A good?
Yep.
And firefighters.
Are they providing a good or a service?
A service.
Oh, good job, buddy. You got it.
Tony Cavero, destined for the Board of Governors. Now, older kids come through the Fed Summer Camp Challenge, too. But these little guys showed so much promise, and like Gray Belcher, had such a strong preference for hawks versus doves.
A hawk.
Why?
Because they're cool.
That I decided to ask them the biggest lesson they'd learned from their day at the Richmond Fed. And like Skanda Athreya, whose dad is a bank economist, they all mentioned the same thing. The bus ride.
I learned on the bus, when the driver's driving, don't distract your driver because it can make them get in a car crash.
Which in the coded language of FedSpeak says a whole lot about how to manage the economy. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, which comes on the heels of the quarterly earnings report from Netflix this afternoon. They did just fine, made about as much money as everybody had been guessing they would make, but that's not really what I wanted to say. Their series Orange is the New Black was the most watched thing on Netflix this quarter in the whole world, which gets us to this. Apparently, the orange jumpsuits in that series have become so chic, I guess would be the word, that the sheriff in Saginaw County, Michigan has had about enough. He said, and this is a quote, "You see people wearing all orange jumpsuits at the mall." So he has started ordering the old style black and white stripe jobs for his inmates. There you go. And with that, we are done. The Dow off 0.25% today, 48 points. The NASDAQ gave back about 0.1%, 7 points. The S&P 500 slipped 0.2%. That is 4 points on that particular index. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.